Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the November 25th Thursday reading of the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Killing of Ahmaud Arbery, Three Murder Convictions by Russ Bynum. Unidentified Aerial Phenomena, Pentagon Group Will Examine Unexplained Sightings by Julian E. Barnes. COVID-19, Cases Drop in Colorado Children by Jessica Seaman. U.S. Unemployment, Jobs Claims Hit 52-Year Low by Paul Wiseman. And following up with miscellaneous articles. Killing of Ahmaud Arbery, Three Murder Convictions. Georgia men face mandatory sentence of life in prison, by Ross Bynum, The Associated Press, Byline, Brunswick, Georgia. Three men were convicted of murder Wednesday in the killing of Ahmaud Arbery, the black man who was running empty-handed through a Georgia subdivision when the white strangers chased him, trapped him on a quiet street, and blasted him with a shotgun. The February 2020 slaying drew limited attention at first, but when video of the shooting leaked online, Arbery's death quickly became another grim marker in the nation's reckoning of the way black people are treated in their everyday lives. Now the men all face a mandatory sentence of life in prison. The judge will decide whether their sentences are served with or without the possibility of parole. As the first of 23 guilty verdicts were read, Arbery's father had to leave the courtroom after leaping up and shouting. At the reading of the last criminal count, Arbery's mother dropped her head and quietly pumped her fists. "He didn't do nothing but run and dream," Marcus Arbery Sr. said of his son. Outside the courthouse, dozens of black supporters hugged and cried. The jury deliberated for about 10 hours before convicting Greg McMichael, son Travis McMichael, and neighbor William Roddy Bryan. The McMichaels grabbed guns and jumped in a pickup to pursue the 25-year-old Arbery after seeing him running outside the Georgia port city of Brunswick. Bryan joined the pursuit in his own pickup and recorded cell phone video of Travis McMichael fatally shooting Arbery. The father and son told police they suspected Arbery was a fleeing burglar, but the prosecution argued that the men provoked the fatal confrontation and that there was no evidence Arbery committed any crimes in the neighborhood. "We commend the courage and bravery of this jury to say that what happened on February 23, 2020 to Ahmaud Arbery, the hunting and killing of Ahmaud Arbery, it was not only morally wrong, but legally wrong, and we are thankful for that," said Latonia Hines, Cobb County Executive Assistant District Attorney. Prosecutor Linda Donikowski added, "The jury system works in this country, and when you present the truth to people and they see it, they will do the right thing." Travis McMichael, 35, stood for the verdict, his lawyer's arm around his shoulder. At one point, he lowered his head to his chest. After the verdicts were read, as he stood to leave, he mouthed, "Love you," to his mother in the courtroom gallery. Greg McMichael, 65, hung his head when the judge read his first guilty verdict. Bryan, 52, bit his lip. Speaking outside the courthouse, Ben Crump, attorney for Arbery's father, repeatedly said the spirit of Ahmaud defeated the lynch mob. Arbery's mother, Wanda Cooper Jones, thanked the crowd gathered for the verdict and said she did not think she would see this day. "It's been a long fight. It's been a hard fight, but God is good," she said, adding that her son would now rest in peace. Travis McMichael's attorneys said he and his father feel that they did the right thing and that they believed the video would help their case, but they also said the McMichaels regret that Arbery got killed. I can tell you honestly, these men are sorry for what happened to Ahmaud Arbery, attorney Jason Sheffield said. They are sorry he's dead. They are sorry for the tragedy that happened because of the choices they made to go out there and try to stop him. They plan to appeal. Brian's attorney, Kevin Goff, said his team was disappointed with the verdict, but we respect it. He planned to file new legal motions after Thanksgiving. Superior Court Judge Timothy Walmsley did not immediately schedule a sentencing date, saying he wanted to give both sides time to prepare. In a statement, President Joe Biden said Arbery's killing was a devastating reminder of how much more work the country has to do in the fight for racial justice. While the guilty verdicts reflect our justice system doing its job, that alone is not enough. Instead, we must recommit ourselves to building a future of unity and shared strength where no one fears violence because of the color of their skin, Biden said. Although prosecutors did not argue that racism motivated the killing, federal authorities have charged them with hate crimes, alleging that they chased and killed Arbery because he was black. That case is scheduled to go to trial in February. The disproportionately white jury received the case around midday Tuesday. Soon after returning to court Wednesday morning, the jury sent a note to the judge asking to view two versions of the shooting video, the original and one that investigators enhanced to reduce shadows, three times apiece. Jurors returned to the courtroom to see the videos and listen again to the 911 call one of the defendants made from a bed of a pickup about 30 seconds before the shooting. On the 911 call the jury reviewed, Greg McMichael tells the operator, "I'm out here in Satilla Shores. There's a black male running down the street." Then he starts shouting, apparently as Arbery is running toward the McMichaels' idling truck, with Brian's truck coming up behind him. "Stop right there. Damn it, stop. Travis." Gunshots can be heard a few seconds later. The graphic video emerged 2 months later, and the Georgia Bureau of Investigation took over the case, quickly arresting the three men. Defense attorneys contend the McMichaels were attempting illegal citizens' arrest when they set off after Arbery, seeking to detain and question him after he was seen running from a nearby home under construction. Travis McMichael testified that he shot Arbery in self-defense. He said Arbery turned and attacked with his fists while running past the truck, where McMichael stood with his shotgun. At the time of his death, Arbery had enrolled at a technical college and was preparing to study to become an electrician like his uncles. Sean Seals, a 32-year-old lifelong Brunswick resident, rushed to the courthouse to join the crowd cheering the verdict. "We just came out to witness history," said Seals, pushing his 10-month-old daughter in a stroller. Seals, who is black, called the convictions a victory, not just for his community, but for the nation. "We're not going to heal most of the wounds from a long history of inequality," he said, "but it's a start and shows people are trying." Unidentified aerial phenomena. Pentagon Group will examine unexplained sightings, by Julian E. Barnes, The New York Times Company, Byline, Washington. The Pentagon on Tuesday night announced a new group to investigate reports of unidentified aerial phenomena in sensitive areas, work that will be overseen by both the military and the intelligence agencies. The group will lead an effort to detect, identify, and attribute objects in restricted airspace, as well as mitigate any threats to military flights. The announcement follows the release of a report in June that failed to provide explanations of 143 sightings of strange phenomena by military pilots and others over the past two decades. The report frustrated some inside the intelligence community, who believed more analysis and research should have been done to try to categorize and explain the phenomena. Releasing a report that said the sightings were unexplained further drove theories that the videos or pictures could be visitors from space, a theory that few in the U.S. government take seriously. Kathleen H. Hicks, the Deputy Defense Secretary, said the new group would be called the Airborne Object Identification and Management Synchronization Group. It will be overseen by an executive council made up of the Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence, the Director of the Joint Staff, and senior officials from the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. The group will focus on special use airspace, which includes military operations areas, firing ranges, and places restricted for national security and other uses. In a memo, Hicks said unidentified aerial phenomena in special use areas represented a potential safety issue for military pilots and raised potential national security concerns. In June, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence released a report that reviewed unidentified aerial phenomena seen since 2004, noting that 143 remained unexplained. Of those, 21 reports involving 18 episodes possibly demonstrated technological know-how unknown to the United States, such as objects moving without observable propulsion or with rapid acceleration that is believed to be beyond the capabilities of Russia, China, or other terrestrial nations. Government officials said privately that there was no evidence of Russian or Chinese advanced technology in use, much less space-traveling aliens, in the information collected. But the officials acknowledged that the government's failure to provide much explanation would fuel a wide range of theories, some more conspiratorial than others. While the unexplained sightings were mostly around military installations or operations, the report said it could be the result of collection bias or the presence of cutting-edge sensors. Some people believe any phenomenon exhibiting technology beyond the capabilities of the United States needs deep study. Skeptics believe most or all of the sightings, including videos recorded by cameras on military fighter jets, can be explained by tricks of optics or naturally occurring phenomena. This month, Avril Haines, the Director of National Intelligence, said the government needed to get better at collecting information about the unexplained phenomena. Haines said the primary focus remained on whether the phenomena were aircraft from rival nations spying on the United States, but held open the possibility of otherworldly explanations. The main issues that Congress and others have been concerned about are basically safety of flight concerns and counterintelligence issues, she said. But of course, there's always a question of, is there something else that we simply do not understand that might come extraterrestrially? Haines' extraterrestrial remark was not necessarily referring to space aliens, but rather more pedestrian explanations, such as meteors and solar flares that could impact flight safety issues. For years, a military intelligence official, Luis Elizondo, ran a little notice group within the Pentagon called the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program. The Pentagon has said the program was shut down in 2012, but backers of the program said its work continued. In 2020, the Pentagon announced it had a new group, the Unidentified Aerial Phenomenon Task Force. The memo released by Hicks said the task force would transition immediately to the new synchronization group. The Oversight Council will choose an acting director for the new group and issue guidance subject to Hicks' approval, she said. The new director will have the power to standardize incident reporting of unidentified aerial phenomena, ask to oversee the analysis of data on the unexplained sightings, and identify shortfalls in detection capabilities. COVID-19, Cases Drop in Colorado Children, by Jessica Seaman, The Denver Post. Coronavirus cases in children dropped slightly last week, but Colorado public health officials warned Wednesday that the state could still see infections rise in the coming weeks as families gather for the holidays. Just over 4,720 children and teens tested positive for COVID-19 during the week between November 14th and November 21st, a 6.6% decrease from the 5,061 cases in the previous week, according to the latest data from the State Health Department. Coloradans ages 5 to 11 accounted for 2,461 of those cases. It's too early to know if the decrease reflects an overall downward trend, given the number of cases among children and teens remains high. Infections rose by 40% from about a month ago, when the state recorded 3,361 cases among those under the age of 18. Young Coloradans have experienced higher rates of infections during the state's current wave of the virus, with transmission highest among children ages 5 to 11. This isn't the time to assume things are getting better, so Dr. Eric France, Chief Medical Officer for the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment, during a news briefing. We have to be vigilant. Overall hospitalizations remain high. As of Wednesday, the state has only 645 beds available, and 1,576 Coloradans were hospitalized with COVID-19 on Tuesday, said Scott Bookman, COVID-19 incident commander. Children are less likely to be hospitalized or die from COVID-19, but the risk exists. They can also develop long COVID or a rare but serious condition called multisystem inflammatory syndrome, or MIS-C, after an infection. Children's Hospital Colorado has seen an increase in children with MIS-C, which can inflame the heart, lungs, and other organs, said Dr. Samuel Dominguez, a pediatric infectious disease specialist at the hospital. He did not have data on how many cases there are. The fact is, we still have a lot of children still unvaccinated, Dominguez said, adding, the next several weeks will potentially provide opportunities for more spread if people gather. Nationally, infections among children increased 32% from about 2 weeks ago, with almost 142,000 American children testing positive for COVID-19 during the week ending on November 18th, according to a report released this week by the American Academy of Pediatrics. At least 81,711 children ages 5 to 11 and 279,796 teens ages 12 to 17 have received at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine, according to the state health department. U.S. unemployment. Jobless claims hit 52-year low. Seasonal adjustments contribute to drop, but employers expect to hire 575,000 this month, by Paul Wiseman, The Associated Press, byline Washington. The number of Americans applying for unemployment benefits plummeted last week to the lowest level in more than half a century, another sign that the U.S. job market is rebounding rapidly from last year's coronavirus recession. Jobless claims dropped by 71,000 to 199,000, the lowest since mid-November 1969. But seasonal adjustments around the Thanksgiving holiday contributed significantly to the bigger-than-expected drop. Unadjusted, claims actually ticked up by more than 18,000 to nearly 259,000. The four-week average of claims, which smooths out weekly ups and downs, also dropped by 21,000 to just more than 252,000, the lowest since mid-March 2020, when the pandemic slammed the economy. Since topping 900,000 in early January, the applications have fallen steadily and now have fallen below their pre-pandemic level of around 220,000 a week. Claims for jobless aid are a proxy for layoffs. Overall, 2 million Americans were collecting traditional unemployment checks the week that ended November 13th, down slightly from the week before. Overall, expect continued volatility in the headline figures, but the trend remains very slowly lower, contingent macro advisors wrote in a research note. Until September 6th, the federal government had supplemented state unemployment insurance programs by paying an extra payment of $300 a week and extending benefits to gig workers and to those who are out of work for 6 months or more. Including the federal programs, the number of Americans receiving some form of jobless aid peaked at more than 33 million in June 2020. The job market has staged a remarkable comeback since spring 2020, when the pandemic forced businesses to close or cut hours, and kept many Americans at home as a health precaution. In March and April last year, employers slashed more than 22 million jobs. But government relief checks, super low interest rates, and the rollout of vaccines combined to give consumers the confidence and financial wherewithal to start spending again. Employers scrambling to meet an unexpected surge in demand have made 18 million hires since April 2020 and are expected to add an additional 575,000 this month. Still, the U.S. remains 4 million short of the jobs it had in February 2020. Companies now complain that they can't find workers to fill job openings, a near-record 10.4 million in September. Workers, finding themselves with bargaining clout for the first time in decades, are becoming choosier about jobs. A record 4.4 million quit in September, a sign they have confidence in their ability to find something better. Discipline. Colorado attorneys suspended, censured, by Shelley Bradbury, The Denver Post. A Colorado attorney who got drunk at work and sexually harassed a subordinate was among several lawyers publicly disciplined by the state in October and November. Attorney Philip Amos, who previously worked for Franklin D. Azar and Associates, received a six-month suspension of his law license, stayed upon the successful completion of 2 years of probation for the incident on October 9, 2020, according to a stipulation filed with the Office of the Presiding Disciplinary Judge, which handles professional discipline for attorneys in Colorado. Amos drank heavily throughout the day and in his Aurora office, according to the stipulation. Visibly intoxicated, he called a subordinate into his office and began to make comments about her body and how she was hot. He used crude and offensive language, the stipulation says. The subordinate reported Amos to the firm's human resources department. He was fired that evening. Amos told disciplinary investigators he did not remember much of what he said or did that afternoon. He said he had been sober since shortly after that day and that he had sought out treatment from mental health professionals. He did not return a request for comment. In a separate case, an attorney received a nine-month stayed suspension for disclosing confidential information. Attorney Carrie Rowieder began a romantic relationship with a married woman he represented. He also represented her husband, and later, during the couple's contentious divorce and custody dispute, disclosed confidential information he'd learned while working as their attorney, according to the stipulation to discipline. Rowieder believed he'd learned the information while acting as a friend to the couple, not as their attorney, according to the stipulation. However, he acknowledges he was still attorney of record in both of their cases at the time, even though there were no active issues in their cases, the stipulation says. Rowieder's suspension will be stayed if he successfully completes 2 years of probation. He did not return a request for comment. In a third case, attorney Robert Wiegand was publicly censured for failing to resolve conflicts of interest with a client and poorly communicating with that client. The discipline was because at one stage over a year, I failed ostensibly to communicate with my client about a potential conflict of interest which never arose, Wiegand said Monday. And any attorney who has worked in estate planning who read the whole thing would be concerned that the Office of Attorney Regulation Counsel would think that was a violation. It just would have cost too much to go to trial. The state in November also filed a complaint against Evergreen attorney Jennifer Emmy, also known as Jennifer Edwards. Emmy, in August, was sentenced to 10 years in prison in a murder-for-hire scheme. That disciplinary case is ongoing. Other attorneys were disciplined in October and November for poor communication with clients, inept bookkeeping, and for professional misconduct in other states. Inflation, supply chain issues. Pandemic isn't over, and neither is food banks' high demand for services. By Judith Kohler, The Denver Post. The day before Thanksgiving, Lana Lopez was in leggings and sweats as she got ready to start loading boxes of food into the hundreds of vehicles expected to line up at the Colorado Community Church in Aurora. Lopez is the coordinator of the church food pantry distribution, which takes place the second and fourth Wednesdays every month. You'd be amazed at how much food we put in those boxes, Lopez said. Those boxes are heavy. We get a good workout. The loads have been particularly heavy through the coronavirus pandemic. The number of cars driving up has ranged from 250 to 300 per distribution. After a dip as restrictions on businesses and events ease, Lopez said the numbers have spiked again. Similar to the Food Bank of the Rockies, which partners with the church and more than 800 other organizations in Colorado and Wyoming, Lopez sees many people who never went to a food pantry before the pandemic. During the height of COVID, about 40% of the people served had never needed food assistance before then. We still continue to see people who had not previously turned to a food bank or pantry for help, said Aaron Pulling, president and CEO of the Denver-based Food Bank of the Rockies. And like the Colorado Community Church, the food bank continues to respond to a high demand. Pulling said the Food Bank of the Rockies distribution volumes shot up 55% to 60% at the height of the pandemic and are hovering between 10% and 15% above pre-pandemic levels. The latest challenge for the food banks and pantries is rising inflation and increasing food prices. Food banks across the country are feeling the effects of inflation and supply chain disruptions, the Associated Press reported. We've seen our price of ground beef, which is such a staple, increase 27% in the last year. Vegetable oil is up 54%. Canned fruit is up 30%, Pulling said. Freight costs are up 25%. Pulling said the food bank has become more efficient, enabling it to distribute enough food for four families for every dollar donated because it buys food by the truckload. Much of the food is donated. But still, we need funds to bring that food in. For the freight costs and the fuel and our labor and inventorying that food and getting it into our distribution system, Pulling said. The Farmers to Families Food Box Program, started by the U.S. Department of Agriculture in 2020, ended in May. Pulling said the program supplied about 30% of the food bank's provisions for a year. The net effect of all those factors has meant a more than tripling of what we are spending on food. We are now spending nearly $1 million every month on food, which is triple what we were spending in 2019, Pulling said. The food bank ordered 7,000 turkeys and nearly 6,000 turkey breasts for this year's Thanksgiving. Those along with the trimmings were distributed to hundreds of food distribution centers and pantries. Pulling said the food bank is also working to distribute more fresh produce and culturally responsive food. A major boost has been financial and technical help from Google. The Food Bank of the Rockies is one of 20 food assistance organizations nationwide to receive a $50,000 grant from the tech giant. Google has also worked with the food bank for the past year to help optimize its delivery routes and give technological support. The company's chief business officer, Philip Schindler, said in a blog that Google formed a team to work on issues of food waste and food insecurity, which have been compounded during the coronavirus crisis. Google has expanded information about food banks and pantries in Google Search and Maps and developed new business profiles for food banks and soup kitchens. Another initiative aims to make information about the federal Supplemental Nutrition and Assistance Program easier to find by providing links to state eligibility guidelines and applications through a search of SNAP benefits or the name of the local program. That's a very impactful grant at a time when Food Bank of the Rockies is depending on community support and financial gifts more than we ever have before, Pulling said of the Google money. That will enable us to distribute 200,000 meals. The grants recognize food banks that are innovative, and Google reviewed hundreds of nonprofits to choose the recipients. Emily Ma, head of the company's Food for Good, said in a statement. The Food Bank of the Rockies has consistently adopted new and innovative ways to get food to people who need it and who are proud to support their work, Ma said. Unique architectural phenomenon, King of the Castle. Creator has been building roadside quirky attractions since 1969 by Sam Tabachnik, the Denver Post. Byline, Rye. Jim Bishop shuffled slowly out onto the rickety metal bridge, high atop the signature castle he has been building in Southern Colorado for more than half a century. His back hunched, the wind whipping, Bishop stopped near the end of the bridge that leads to nowhere. He turned, grabbing the iron railing. A wry smile appeared on his face as he shook the bridge back and forth, his slight frame swaying in the cool mountain breeze. "If I built it," Bishop said, "I can sure walk on it." At 77, Bishop still has a wild side to him, the kind of attitude that tells you to keep building a castle in the middle of nowhere by hand and by yourself since 1969. But what happens when the king of the castle can no longer rule? Bishop Castle, one of Colorado's quirkiest roadside attractions, is in the midst of a transitional period after decades of autocratic rule, a bridge without a clear destination. Bishop beat the cancer that doctors thought he would never overcome, but Parkinson's disease has taken a toll on the builder. These days, he spends more of his time taking medication and resting by the fire than stacking stones, his son, Dan, having taken over day-to-day operations of Bishop's magnum opus. "Danny wants me to rest on my butt," Jim Bishop said with a smile. "But if this probation goes too long, I'll say, go to hell." Dan Bishop isn't sure what's next for Bishop Castle because there are no blueprints, just a vision from the creator himself. He's building a new gift shop to replace the one that burned down in 2018 and may eventually connect the bridge that leads to nowhere. He vows never to sell the land, but it all feels a bit weird to Dan. This isn't his masterpiece. "If someone picked up a Picasso and started painting on it," he said, "then it's not a Picasso anymore." The legend of Bishop Castle. Now in its seventh decade, Bishop Castle continues to wow visitors from its perch along Colorado 165 near the small town of Rye, nestled at 9,000 feet in the San Isabel National Forest. By now, its origin story is the stuff of legend. Bishop says he bought the 2.5-acre plot of land at 15 years old for $450 as a way to escape from Pueblo. Over the next 10 years, he and his father, Willard, began laying the groundwork for a family cabin using stones from nearby mountains. As they built, neighbors remarked that the building looked awfully like a castle. Bishop's father wanted nothing to do with a project of that magnitude, but Jim Bishop saw something there. So he continued to build and build and build. On his website, Bishop claims his castle is the country's, and maybe even the world's, largest one-man project, although he's only been on a plane twice in his life. The castle is hardly a local secret anymore. It's featured on travel sites such as TripAdvisor and has been promoted on countless travel lists. 13 of the most Instagrammable locations in Colorado, or 10 weird and wonderful Colorado attractions. "We don't have a lot going on," said Deb Adams, Custer County's tourism chief, with a laugh. "Bishop Castle is one of our main attractions in Custer County. It's such a unique architectural phenomenon. Just the history of how it was built, how quirky it is." On a recent November day, the air unusually mild under an overcast sky, Bishop came to his castle ready to work, at least for a short while. His current project consists of building a wall around the entire property, a task that will take him the rest of his life, he said. Visitors from El Salvador stopped Bishop to take pictures with him in front of his life's work, and he happily obliged. "They're more likely to donate if I do," Bishop said with a smile. After loading up his yellow wheelbarrow, Bishop slowly pushed it down the hill, pausing at the bottom to rest. Clad in a blue-stained Jim Bishop polo shirt and worn jeans, the builder remarked that his joints feel real good today, although one of his hands was visibly swollen, an ace bandage wrapped around it. "I'm getting younger," he said. With great care, Bishop tossed the rocks on top of one another. He has adapted with age, learning to pivot on his feet to save himself steps. Bishop looked across the two-lane road. He walks over there occasionally to pick up trash, the same place where his four-year-old son, Roy, died in a tree-felling accident more than 30 years ago. "He's safe," Bishop said. He's in heaven. Bishop is not a religious man. He doesn't believe in it, much like his feelings on the White House, but he talks about God often. I'm God just by doing this, he said. We're all gods. The castle has been host to some 350 weddings over the years, Bishop guessed. All he asks is for a small deposit to reserve the day. Otherwise, the place is yours. The castle has always been free, partly out of kindness and partly because the building can't be insured. Its magnificence, the stained glass windows in the chapel, the ornate, twisting metal staircases, the menacing dragon's head, belies the fact that it's still an open construction site. Metal hangs low through arch entrances, small ropes cordon off areas where one could fall dozens of feet to the ground with a simple misstep. There have been no serious injuries at the castle, the bishop said, although one woman did die from a heart attack on a buttress near the castle's base. Raves, drugs, and a wedding gone wrong. The castle has become one of Custer County's most prominent attractions, but the builder's relationship with local officials over the years has been complicated. Bishop started construction on the castle before the county had zoning laws, said Jackie Hobby, a Custer County planning and zoning official. We don't, at this point in time, have any apparent issues with them, she said. Bishop said, county officials mostly have let him alone over the years, although that omits some relatively consequential details. When Jim and his wife, Phoebe, were going through some struggles in the late 1990s, she started dancing at nightclubs, Dan Bishop said. Jim wanted his wife at the castle, so what did they do? They brought the party to Bishop Castle. And by party, Bishop meant raves. 3-day, drug-filled benders with as many as 1,500 people that began on Friday night and didn't stop until Sunday afternoon. Ravers once built a human wall on the highway just because, Dan Bishop said. Mosh pits formed on the third level of the castle. People were literally passing out upside down, sleeping in the middle of the yard, Dan said. Tourists would come Saturday morning and find these drunk and high partiers littering the landscape. That was a really bizarre time in the existence of Bishop Castle. These parties drew the ire of neighbors and got the attention of county commissioners and law enforcement officials who received complaints from trespassing and public urination to overt drug use and excessive noise, the Denver Post reported in a 1998 story about the raves. I've had people tell me they are afraid to go outside of their homes on weekends because of the types of clientele he has, and they're afraid to go and leave their home vacant, Custer County Commissioner Cleo Day told the Post at the time. That's not fair to the surrounding residents. The county eventually got a court-ordered injunction to stop the debauchery. But in 2002, a wedding-turned-rave provided one of the most dramatic moments in the castle's storied history. One that could have ended the entire project. The way Dan tells it, some ravers wanted to get around the injunction, so they threw a wedding at the castle instead. That wedding turned into an all-night party. They refused to stop, Dan said, and it turned into a gunfight. Dan said he made a noise with a gunshot to get people to leave. The next thing you know, it's a 2-year battle with the court system over 17 felonies. Dan and his father were charged with a host of felony menacing counts. They went all the way to trial, with a Custer County jury finding Jim not guilty on all charges. Dan was acquitted on 16 of the 17 counts, receiving 30 days in jail and 2 years of probation for reckless endangerment, court records show. I was happy to serve my 30 days, Dan Bishop said. The castle is the way it is today, a nice, calm, do-what-you-want experience, Dan said, because of what he went through during that 7-day trial. It's been a life, Dan said with a laugh. Tom Flower, a current Custer County commissioner, chuckled when the Post reporter called about Bishop Castle. Flower likes to tell people that if they want the real Bishop Castle experience, holler for Jim and tell him you think the government is doing a good job. He'll lose his mind. There are numerous signs outside the castle that let visitors know exactly how Bishop goes about his life. and he frequently goes off on diatribes about various government entities and their dysfunction or alleged sinister dealings. You might experience foul language, one sign reads outside the castle. You might experience strongly expressive behavior. Roadside America, an online guide to offbeat tourist attractions, added a disclaimer on the bottom of its Bishop Castle entry, saying, Bishop's Castle may look like Hogwarts, but Jim Bishop is no cuddly Dumbledore. He's a tough-talking man with strong beliefs, and sometimes he expresses them bluntly and loudly. If you or your children want to avoid potentially offensive rants, you may want to stay clear. Bishop was arrested in 2016 and charged with a series of bias-motivated crimes after authorities say he repeatedly yelled a racial slur and threatened a group of black tourists visiting his castle, according to a sheriff's incident report. A jury acquitted him on all charges, court records show. What's next for Bishop Castle? When he's not working, Jim Bishop likes to sit by the campfire on the site of the not-yet-built gift shop next to the castle with his dog Marley, an excitable brown spaniel. He pulled out old pictures of Phoebe, who died of cancer 3 years ago. They were married 50 years, and Bishop invokes her name often. He recalled the time Phoebe took a halogen light miles away to test how far you could see it from the top of the castle. They used to discuss who would play each other in the movie of their lives. Bishop pulling for Catherine Zeta-Jones to portray Phoebe, while she quipped that he should be played by Clint Eastwood. After a few minutes, tears streamed down his cheek, Bishop's body shaking slightly. She did a lot for me, I'll tell you, Bishop said quietly, looking at a younger portrait of his wife. Guess I'll put him back in the case now. As he and Phoebe fought their own forms of cancer, I felt like dying then, Bishop said, but God had more plans for me. With his cancer gone, it's Parkinson's and bipolar disorder that have led Bishop to cede the castle's reins to his son. He holds out his palms. See? No shakes, Bishop said. But Dan Bishop has had to put his father on a type of probation, changing the code on the Bobcat construction vehicle and taking his father's car keys to save him from himself. I think his mind will go before his body, Dan said. Dad lives in a fantasy world sometimes. His father goes through spells of mania that he can't control, even ending up in court recently after he fought someone over crayons at a behavioral health unit. I am a diagnosed maniac, but not a maniac, Jim Bishop says with a laugh. Dan sold his house in Puebla and moved in with his father to provide more care. A granddaughter has started caring for Jim once a week. One of Jim's three surviving children, Dan said he's known in his heart that I'd take over here. Still, he acknowledged that this one here is a drastic transition. He's got the gift shop on the docket and hopes to add a six-table eatery, too. Perhaps he will install a button visitors could press that would give information on different parts of the castle. Dan doesn't plan to hire a crew to do any of the work. That's not in the bishop's nature. But even as Dan takes on more and more of the operations, Jim Bishop is still here multiple days a week, lugging bright yellow wheelbarrows full of rocks. Despite the probation, Dan doesn't fret about his father continuing to work. If he dies doing that, that wouldn't be the worst way to go, he said. Sometimes I wonder if I'm going to go looking for him and find him dead. Dan disagrees with his father's technique of dry stacking rocks to build the well around the castle. But he doesn't intervene. He just lets his dad keep doing what he's been doing. Who am I to tell him not to build a castle, right? Dan said. Spacecraft launch. NASA to test asteroid defense concept. DART mission aims to nudge asteroid off course after September collision. By John Antsak, The Associated Press. Byline, Los Angeles. NASA launched a spacecraft Tuesday night on a mission to smash into an asteroid and test whether it would be possible to knock a speeding space rock off course if one were to threaten Earth. The DART spacecraft, short for Double Asteroid Redirection Test, lifted off from Vandenberg Space Force Base atop a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket with a $330 million project with echoes of the Bruce Willis movie Armageddon. If all goes well, the boxy 1,200-pound craft will slam head-on into Dimorphos, an asteroid 525 feet across, at 15,000 miles per hour in September. This isn't going to destroy the asteroid. It's just going to give it a small nudge, said mission official Nancy Shabbat of Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory, which is managing the project. Dimorphos orbits a much larger asteroid called Didymos. The pair are no danger to Earth, but offer scientists a better way to measure the effectiveness of a collision than a single asteroid flying through space. Dimorphos completes one orbit of Didymos every 11 hours 55 minutes. DART's goal is a crash that will slow Dimorphos down and cause it to fall closer toward the bigger asteroid, shaving 10 minutes off its orbit. The change in the orbital period will be measured by telescopes on Earth. The minimal change for the mission to be considered a success is 73 seconds. The DART technique could prove useful for altering the course of an asteroid years or decades before it bears down on Earth with the potential for catastrophe. A small nudge would add up to a big change in its future position, and then the asteroid and the Earth wouldn't be on a collision course, Shabbat said. Scientists constantly search for asteroids and plot their courses to determine whether they could hit the planet. DART will take 10 months to reach the asteroid pair. The collision will occur about 6.8 million miles from Earth. 10 days beforehand, DART will release a tiny observation spacecraft supplied by the Italian Space Agency that will follow it. DART will stream video until it is destroyed on impact. 3 minutes later, the trailing craft will make images of the impact site and material that is ejected. The $324 million DART mission is unusual for NASA, a civilian agency that focuses mainly on exploration, climate monitoring, and hunting for signs of past life in our solar system. While it coordinates with and relies on the U.S. Department of Defense for some activities, NASA has not traditionally been responsible for leading efforts to protect the United States, or Earth for that matter, from any security threat. The New York Times contributed to this report. Germany. Coalition of three parties will end the Merkel era, by Geir Molson and Frank Jordans, the Associated Press, Byline, Berlin. Germany's would-be governing parties vowed Wednesday to modernize Europe's biggest economy and increase efforts against climate change, as they announced an agreement that leaves center-left leader Olaf Scholz poised to replace longtime Chancellor Angela Merkel within weeks. The coalition will shift Germany's leadership a bit to the left after 16 years under the center-right Merkel, who gained plaudits for her handling of a series of crises over the years. Scholz signaled that the country's foreign policy would not change much. Scholz's Social Democrats, the environmentalist Greens, and the pro-business Free Democrats are set to take the reins just as Germany faces its biggest surge of coronavirus infections in the pandemic so far, a reality that somewhat overshadowed the launch. Scholz opened the event by promising that the new government will do everything necessary to bring us through this time well. The three-party alliance is a first for a German government and creates strange bedfellows with two left-leaning parties and one, the Free Democrats, that in recent decades allied with the center-right. But Scholz promised it as a big opportunity. The new government will not seek the lowest common denominator, but the politics of big impacts, he promised. Scholz, 63, said he expects that members of the three parties will give their blessing to the deal in the next 10 days. The biggest challenge is a vote by the Greens' 125,000-strong membership. The other two parties plan to sign off on it at conventions during the first weekend in December, paving the way for Parliament to elect Scholz as chancellor during the week starting December 6. Scholz has been Merkel's finance minister and vice chancellor since 2018 in the outgoing Grand Coalition of Germany's traditional big parties, in which his party was a junior partner, Merkel didn't run for a fifth term, and her Christian Democrats will head into opposition after a disastrous campaign that ended with defeat in Germany's September 26 election. We will take over the government in a time of crisis, Green co-leader Robert Habeck acknowledged, describing the coalition deal as a sign of courage and confidence that fits those times. The guiding principle of this government is a society that acts, a state that invests, and a Germany that simply works. Key pledges by the prospective partners includes an increase in the minimum wage to $13.50 per hour from the current $10.75, a move that Scholz said means a wage increase for 10 million citizens, and they also aim to get 400,000 new apartments per year built to curb rising rental prices. Habeck also said measures planned by the government would put Germany on a path to meet the goals of the 2015 Paris Climate Accord. It also intends to bring forward Germany's exit from coal-fueled power by 2038, ideally completing it in 2030. Habeck added that, instead of formally setting new goals for reducing greenhouse gas emissions, it will focus on concrete measures, including ensuring that the price per ton of carbon dioxide won't fall below $67, a measure that will speed the coal phase-out. At the Free Democrats' insistence, the prospective partners said they won't raise taxes or loosen curbs on running up debt. The pro-business party's leader, Christian Lindner, said, "Together we have a mission to modernize this country." He proclaimed that we are going to digitize the state. That's a challenge in a country that has notoriously patchy internet and cell phone coverage, and where government services are often offline. Lindner, who is set to become finance minister, also said the coalition would implement more liberal social policies. Those include legalizing the sale of cannabis for recreational purposes in licensed shops. The new government plans to place a greater emphasis on the welfare and participation of children and young people. The coalition deal says it will aim to lower the voting age in European elections from 18 to 16 and aim to change Germany's constitution so 16-year-olds can vote in federal elections too. Looking beyond Germany, Scholz stressed the importance of a strong Europe, friendship with France and partnership with the United States as key cornerstones of the new government's foreign policy, continuing a long post-war tradition. It's typical in Germany for coalitions to draw detailed agreements for their four-year terms. This one runs to 177 pages. The Social Democrats will get 7 cabinet ministers, including the defense and health portfolios, as well as the chancellery. The Greens will get 5, including the foreign minister and a minister for economy and climate protection, a new combination. Neither party announced who would get those jobs. The Free Democrats will get 4 ministries, including the key finance portfolio that goes to Lindner. In news briefs from Denver Post Wire Services, Justice Department to prioritize violence on flights. Byline, Washington. Attorney General Merrick Garland instructed U.S. attorneys across the country to swiftly prioritize prosecution of federal crimes that happen on commercial flights, as federal officials face a historic number of investigations into passenger behavior. Garland's memo, issued Wednesday, emphasizes that the Justice Department is committed to aggressively prosecuting violent passengers who assault crew members or endanger the safety of other passengers. Federal law prohibits interfering with a flight crew, including assaulting, intimidating, or threatening crew members. In a statement, Garland said such passengers do more than harm employees. They prevent the performance of critical duties that help ensure safe air travel. Similarly, when passengers commit violent acts against other passengers in the close confines of a commercial aircraft, the conduct endangers everyone aboard, he said. Instagram chief agrees to testify as Congress probes apps' effects on young people. Adam Mosseri, The leader of Instagram has agreed for the first time to testify before Congress as bipartisan anger mounts over harms to young people from the app. Mosseri is expected to appear before a Senate panel during the week of December 6 as part of a series of hearings on protecting children online, said Senator Richard Blumenthal, Democrat of Connecticut, who will lead the hearing. Mosseri's appearance follows hearings this year with Antigone Davis, global head of safety for Meta, the parent company of Instagram and Facebook, and with Frances Haugen, a former Facebook employee turned whistleblower. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler.
Students with disabilities in Douglas County want some time after a federal judge ruled last week that a new health order making mask wearing optional in school would put students at risk of irreparable harm. But with a new conservative-leaning school board set to take over at the end of the month, that reprieve could be short-lived. David Monroe with Disability Law Colorado says if the new board decides to embrace the health order, students and families would be back at square one.
What's at stake here is the right for especially students with disabilities to have a right to get the same public education every other child does, but to get that education in an atmosphere which is safe to them, does not compromise or jeopardize their health.
Families of students with disabilities and the Douglas County School District took the county's new health department to court, arguing that making masks optional was a violation of the 1990 Americans with Disabilities Act. Last week, a U.S. district judge ordered the health department to stop enforcement of the order for 14 days. County health officials disagreed with the judge's decision and claimed the order strikes the right balance between public health and parental choice. Children with disabilities frequently face serious health challenges, and Monroe says many parents pulled their kids out of school during COVID surges, uncertain if mask mandates were being followed. But when kids aren't in school, Monroe says they're losing out on their right to an appropriate public education.
There are children who have had health issues that may leave them immunosuppressed or immunocompromised. They can be at a much higher risk of having a very serious health outcome if they get COVID.
Douglas County School District's president welcomed the court's temporary restraining order and said in a statement that no one should have to choose between sending their children to school and putting their health at risk. This is Eric Gladys reporting for the Colorado News Connection. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's time for Turkey Trivia. Over the next several minutes, you'll hear a series of questions, and the first person I hear answer one correctly will get a fun Thanksgiving prize. Are you ready? Turkey in the straw, well, what do you say? Roll him up and twist him up a high tuck a ha, and heat him up a toot and call the turkey in the straw. Here's question number one. Which president of the 20th century changed the date of Thanksgiving in order to create a longer Christmas shopping season, but due to public uproar, changed it back 2 years later? Here's question number two. This one's about eating utensils. When you're sitting down at the table, ready to eat a hearty Thanksgiving dinner, and you notice that there are 3 forks to the left of your plate, well, it might seem very confusing, but which one do you use first? The outside, the middle, or the one closest to your plate? And now question number three. Please tell me the name of this famous Cole Porter musical that takes place on a ship and whose signature tune has the same name as the title and this following phrase in it. When they landed on Plymouth Rock would land on them. And here's question number four, folks. Please tell me the name of the film that features the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade prominently and stars a very young Natalie Wood. And now for question number five. This question is for children to answer. Please tell me on what day of the week does Thanksgiving always fall? And now for the final question. This might be a little bit difficult, so I'm going to offer you a multiple-choice answer. You've just purchased a 23-pound turkey, and it looks plump and large and just gorgeous. You've seasoned it, stuffed it, and it's ready to go into the oven. You've set the temperature at 350 degrees, and according to cooking charts, you must cook each pound for 20 minutes. So, do you have to cook the turkey for 3 hours and 20 minutes? Or is it 7 hours and 40 minutes? Or do you have to cook the turkey for 23 hours? Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for playing Turkey Trivia.